Welcome to another episode of The First Incision, a CMF podcast, where we explore issues affecting our Christian lives as medics in today's world. I'm your host, Dr. James Howitt, and I'm here with Dr. Kate. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome.
So Dr. Kate is a GP at a university town who has come today to talk to us about dealing with transgender patients. Transgender is one of those topics that is very hotly disputed at the moment within medicine, and it's important that we understand how as Christians we can relate theologically, but also that how we relate on a personal level. It's important that we recognise that we are going to be seeing these type of patients, and how do we treat them with love and with the respect that they deserve, and show them the love of Christ and manage their medical problems appropriately. So Dr. Kate, thank you so much. It's lovely to have you with us. How's your journey down?
Very straightforward, actually. Nice and the trains were running to time. There were no holdups. It was all very easy indeed. Thank you.
And what kind of stuff did you get up to? Because we've just had a bank holiday weekend. Okay, it's been nice, that's right. Nice of a 3-day weekend. What kind of stuff did you get up to?
Well, we drove down to Pembroke, which was quite a quick journey. And then we spent time with relatives of my husband's. Mm-hmm. And then on Saturday, we went out to an island off the west coast of Pembroke, which has a particularly large puffin colony and a number of very rare birds, half the world's sheer mankwater birds or something
half
like that.
Half the world's what, sorry?
I have no idea. Something like sheer mankwater or something like that.
And so is this your first time? Have you been to the CMF offices before?
No, I've never been here before.
Welcome.
No, really
all right.
Interested.
OK, well, when we're done, I'll take you on the tour anyway.
Yes, please.
It's slightly more glamorous than the loos downstairs, which I showed you right at the beginning.
I was just finding the lights going down and coming back up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I'm glad you didn't get lost down there anyway. It would have been a real shame given that you'd come all this way. So it'd be great to kick off. So tell us, how have you come to have a particular interest in helping transgender patients?
Well, it's sort of been something that's happened to me because of the sudden increase in patients presenting with this particular issue. Until 2014, I'd been at the surgery for, I guess, about 20 years. And we had less than half a dozen patients who would describe themselves as transgender. And then suddenly in October of 2014, there was this huge increase in the number of people presenting. And I had three in one month in October. My colleagues were experiencing something quite similar.
So a real influx of patients.
We had to learn quickly. We had to equip ourselves with the knowledge that we needed.
So it's obviously really great that you're here with us and that you've got this kind of breadth of experience. I think before we delve into anything, it's so important that we understand the language that we're using, because things can be very easily misconstrued. Are you able to just define for us the basic terms that we're going to be using so that we're all on the same page?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the word transgender means very specifically people who have a gender identity or gender expression that differs from the gender that they were assigned at birth. So that's quite an umbrella term for a whole range of different expressions. And that can include and does include people with gender dysphoria, people that would describe themselves as bi-gender or pan-gender or genderqueer. So it's quite important to recognise that word transgender is a very, very broad term mm-hmm. that incorporates a lot of different components. I think the next word that I would, or expression that I would really want to get my head around would be gender dysphoria, which is a condition where a person experiences discomfort, and that's the important thing, discomfort or distress, because there's a mismatch between their biological sex and their gender identity. And the really crucial bit is the distress. There are many people that would describe themselves as transgender who would not experience distress. And another expression is birth sex or sex assigned at birth, and that's essentially it speaks for itself, really. What you're described as when you're born, your DNA, your XY chromosome equals a boy, XX equals a girl. And then another one's gender identity. One's gender identity is one's internal or deeply held sense of one's gender. And so for transgender people, their own internal gender identity doesn't match the sex they were assigned at birth. Whereas for the vast majority of us, we do identify with the gender assigned at birth. And you and I would be called, you would be called a cis male, I'd be called a cis female, CIS, it's the Latin for the same. Whereas trans men would be the opposite, and a trans female is someone that was assigned male at birth. Another expression is FTM, female to male to female, MTF.
So a trans female would be someone who was assigned the male gender at birth,
yes,
and who now identifies as a female, is that
yes.
correct? And the
yes.
same, obviously, reverse for a trans
around,
male.
Yes.
Okay. So can you give us an idea of how widespread this has been within your own clinical practice? What kind of scope of patients are you expecting to see in general practice?
Well, I guess 15 years ago, if you'd asked that question, the statistics that would have been expressed would have been something like for gender dysphoria, so for the distress, there would have been something like 1 in 10,000 men expressing gender dysphoria and 1 in 20,000 women expressing gender dysphoria. But those figures seem to be changing. And more recently, the figures suggest that those that would express themselves as transgender is something like 1 in 180 now, which is considerably
significantly higher, yeah.
And people that would be describe themselves as possibly gender non-conforming, so not fitting into their birth gender, or possibly a transgender in an easy way, or possibly expressing themselves perhaps as non-binary, then that could be as high as something like 1 in 100.
Right, okay.
And in our practice, I think we have something like 20 patients with gender dysphoria and possibly nearer 50 that would be gender non-conforming.
Wow.
So that's a huge change in a very short space of time.
And obviously that's a new population group of patients that have very unique medical needs that we need to be able to. Now, I know we're not going to be discussing kind of specifically the integral medicine, if you like. That's a kind of outside the scope of this podcast. But some of the things to kind of think and bear in mind. So what kind of challenges have you faced when treating someone whose identity and their gender identity is not the same as their birth gender?
I think the vocabulary that one uses is very important in connecting. I think the first thing is, how do you connect? How do you form a relationship with someone? And the start for me has been using the pronouns that they prefer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. I think another has been time pressure, because they come with a whole background of issues very often, and you want to be able to hear their story and get to grips with that in a deep way, and that requires time. So we have the time pressure as well. I've found that occasionally I find myself confused by the appearance and struggling to know how to interact. And a lesson that I learned relatively early on was always to remember their whole story, to remember their birth gender, and to hold that in the front of your mind, because that does simplify everything. Of course, I don't say that out loud to them, and I hope that they would never have a sense of me treating them as their birth gender, but as I relate to them, that helps me think without confusion.
And I'm sure people, there are medical problems that are specific to specific birth genders, which actually will remain the same in a lot of ways, regardless of what gender you identify as, I'm sure. You mentioned the pronouns. I mean, that's using correct pronouns. I mean, even that is something which is not a unanimous decision amongst everyone, and there's discussion around whether using pronouns is the correct kind of way to go for people. Can you tell us about how you kind of came to that decision? You said, I'm going to use the pronouns that people have asked me to use. What were your thought processes behind that?
I wanted to be able to connect with people.
Okay.
And At the first step, using the correct pronoun will enable that to happen. If I don't do that, well, then the relationship will last one consultation.
Yes.
And they will go on to one of my colleagues. And I really do want to look after people that are wrestling with this working their way through this. And I therefore need to start where they're at and listen to them very carefully. And so I will, if necessary, ask them what pronoun that they want to use, or I'll ask them what pronoun they would prefer me to use. Mm-hmm.
Just like you would with a lot of patients,
exactly,
you'd ask them
exactly,
about how they'd want to be referred to.
Or doctor or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been problematic so far. If someone felt that they found it uncomfortable using a preferred pronoun, then I would opt for using the person's name
right
at every time that you would use a pronoun.
Mm,
and that way you're sort of acting with your own personal integrity whilst respecting the person opposite to you.
Indeed. I like that. That's really good. Thank you. So, I mean, obviously part of the ongoing management for some of these patients, at least, is referral to the gender dysphoria clinic. Does that kind of come with any specific challenges making those referrals? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I'm sure for most people, it's not something we've ever done before.
Well, the Royal Colleges, the Royal College of Psychiatrists and the Royal College of GPs encourages us to refer quickly. Mm-hmm. If we have a patient who has gender dysphoria, because of the understanding that the suicide rate is very high indeed.
Sorry to interrupt. So does that mean that you'd refer on the first consultation often, or?
Well, my experience has led me not to do that.
Okay.
So initially I did, but I don't any longer. Mm-hmm. Because I want to really get to know their story, and
right,
I really want to spend time with people and build up a rapport. But when you refer to the adult gender identity clinics, you have a very long form that goes through the psychiatric and medical background and also the social aspect of these decisions for the patient. But right at the end, there is a sentence that says something to the effect of, in referring the patient, you commit to prescribing the hormones that the gender identity clinic may or may not recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot refer the patient unless you sign up to that. I did try and sign up and crossed out that bit, but the form was bounced back.
Right.
So it is unusual. I'm not aware of any other place where you, in a sense, dare I say it, abdicate responsibility for prescribing before the patient has actually been seen. So I have a question about that. I feel uncomfortable with that. But another issue is that the hormones that are prescribed for gender dysphoria or treating people with transgender issues, the cross hormones, the estrogen and the testosterone, are not licensed in gender dysphoria other than Sustanon, which is a testosterone injection that you get injected every 3 months. But all the others are not licensed. And that means that I am responsible for any problems that arise as a result of these drugs that are being prescribed by me.
And that must put you in quite a difficult position, obviously.
Well, it does, because the Medical Defence Union is quite clear that if you put your name at the bottom of the prescription, you are responsible for any problems that might occur. Mm. So there seems to be a bit of a disconnect in terms of, or I'm caught between, it feels like a rock and a hard place, yeah, in terms of treating people. I want them to be seen by the gender identity clinic, potentially, but I can't get them seen unless I agree to prescribe the hormones that I have very little experience of prescribing and for which I am responsible for, if there's a problem. And there are problems, potentially. These hormones come with side effects.
I mean, that, yeah, I can totally understand what you're saying about being between a rock and a hard place. How have you personally managed to kind of marry those two things?
Well, the Gender Identity Clinic does send us a very fulsome letter giving us plenty of advice about the frequency of monitoring these medications, blood tests, and...
So they don't just leave you totally on an island with nothing.
Not at all, not at all. So that's helpful. So I, you know, follow that to the letter, really. I'm finding I'm wrestling with this one.
Okay.
I am wrestling with this one. And I have yet to speak to the GMC and ask them what would be their particular view on all of this. And also, the Medical Defence Union were a little surprised to discover that this letter had this particular disclaimer at the end.
I can imagine. Well, maybe we'll get an update from you in due course in a further episode. That'd be very interesting. So we've already spoken quite a lot, really, about language and about different pronouns. But can you tell us about a time when, kind of specifically, language has been an issue for you when dealing with transgender patients?
Yes. Early on in... When I was just starting to get to know people struggling with this, one of my first trans female patients gave to me a document that had been written by the LGBT group within the local university on how GPs should deal with transgender patients. And included within that document was a vocabulary that was preferred, which I found very interesting indeed. And so one of the things that they suggested was that you don't talk about sex change, you talk about transitioning, and you don't be specific with the type of surgery. You don't talk about breast augmentation or reduction, you talk about top surgery. And the alternative is bottom surgery. And so that was very interesting, along with all the pronouns that were preferred as well. Yes, that gave me pause for thought.
I can imagine. And how, I mean, I feel that's a very quintessential kind of seen as a problem, if you like, in GP patients that come with, you know, with letters and things and other things to give to their doctor, I guess. How did that feel as a professional? Do you think that was a beneficial thing for you to have? Or
where I work, it's not particularly unusual.
Right.
And I it made me smile. It made me a little bit very slightly nose out of joint, but only for 5 minutes.
Okay. And then, so what other concerns do we as clinicians need to have around these patients and kind of pick when we're dealing with patients with transgender? What kind of other things do we need to be thinking about?
Well, it is important to remember the birth gender, because when people choose to identify as a gender different from the one that they were assigned at birth, The medical records, if they've asked for this, the medical records change the gender, and therefore they come off all the screening programs that would be normally assigned to their, normally attributed to their birth gender. So any trans male will no longer have any breast screening or any cervical screening. And obviously for trans females, that would be... prostate screening if that was something that was necessary. or and therefore you just have to remember these potential illnesses, and of course cardiovascular risk and all the other things that will occur more particularly with one gender than the other. So remembering that is very important. And there is no mechanism at the moment for routinely calling up a trans male for cervical screening. They would have to remember to do that themselves.
Actually, that burden falls to kind of you as the GP, yeah, does it then, yeah, to remember that, yeah, that's a,
yeah,
gosh, wow. Because, yeah, of course, yeah, that's something that if the computer says gender male,
that's
then you,
right,
wouldn't think about having to do,
right,
those kind of things. That's really interesting.
And the other thing that's important is, of course, contraception. You have to choose that more carefully. If someone is taking testosterone, you can't use estrogen-based products, of course. But it means that you have to think about pregnancy as another issue if you're dealing with a trans male. And something that I've learned is that your sexual orientation has no bearing whatsoever on your gender identity. And so remembering that means that I can remember to think fertility-related issues in people that come to me with various different problems.
I feel like that really is an ultimate kind of holistic approach to patients, really, isn't it? And treating the whole patient that you see in front of you.
Yes.
That's there. So, I mean, apart from, obviously, we talked a little bit about physical health, there's obviously a number of mental health
yes.
consequences associated with gender dysphoria
yes.
and with transgender. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, that's a huge part. So the statistics suggest that the suicide rate is 20 times higher in people that have transitioned than in the rest of the population.
Gosh.
And also, you know, more than 40% of them will have attempted suicide at some point in time. So that's really significant. It doesn't mean that transitioning increases your suicide rate, because you just don't know what might have been the case if they hadn't transitioned.
Of course.
But it does mean that we need to have a have that very much on our radar when we're looking after people dealing with these issues, and really think to care about them very carefully indeed.
Wow, gosh. I mean, as this is something that I've found myself wrestling with, and I'm sure many people listening have. As a Christian doctor, how do you see your role, I guess, in the management of transgender patients? Are there specific kind of tensions that you come across, and how do you manage those things? How would you kind of encourage us to be managing those?
Well, I find myself thinking that it seems to me that there's a secular ideology that's really driving the therapeutic approaches ahead of the supporting medical evidence. And it's curious to me that we are giving medication that supports someone's gender identity very much more so than looking at how we might support them within their birth sex. And I just wonder if that is right. I'm waiting for the evidence to support the particular approach that we're pursuing at the moment. But at the moment, it is really lacking. It is lacking.
Okay. And that must be really difficult as a clinician to try.
Yes.
And obviously,
yeah.
you're doing, as you've said, what you believe is the best way of kind of being in a relationship and showing love and being with patients. But that must be really difficult when actually we're maybe even taking a little bit of a stab in the dark with regards to treating these patients.
I think it's going to take 20 or 30 years before we know whether this is the right mode of action.
Okay.
I look forward to seeing the results in 20 to 30 years time.
Right. Okay. I mean, everything we've talked about so far really has been around adults and that kind of stuff. But obviously this is not a condition which only affects adults. This is very much a debate around children as well. Can you tell us a bit about any experiences you've had with children identifying as transgender? Because obviously that will raise a whole different set of questions.
I've only had one child brought to me, a 9-year-old who I referred to the gender identity clinic. It brings a whole lot of different issues. children vary so much in how they perceive themselves. And that is an area that changes constantly. And I do know that the clinic in London that seeks to look after these children tries to adopt a very, very flexible approach so that it's accommodating to the child's needs as they progress through their life. 25% of children under the age of 12 are started on puberty blockers. Now, these puberty blockers are there to give them a bit more time as they approach puberty and give them some thinking space, and used as a diagnostic tool. They're also thought to be reversible, completely reversible. But I think the truth is that nothing is totally reversible. And these hormones may cause changes in the brain that we're not yet fully aware of. It may result in changes within the society that the individual is circulating with in. And if, as it seems, that once a child does start on physical treatment, they continue on it, that means that a child of less than 12 is starting on treatment that is going to affect their fertility long term. And I just wonder to what extent children of that age can really grasp the significance of infertility, health changes, possible increased cancer risk for some treatments. And I am concerned about that. I'm sure the clinic involved is wrestling with that as well. I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure that is.
And when you refer children to the clinic, does one have to sign the same disclaimer about prescribing then?
No, absolutely not. Okay. In fact, the clinic is very clear that they do have endocrine experts looking after the children because they feel that that's way beyond the remit of a GP.
Dr. Kate, thank you so much for coming in. It's been really great to hear everything that you have to say. This is obviously something that you've really struggled with or kind of wrestled with yourself, and something that I'm sure a lot of our listeners are wrestling with as well. Do you have one kind of take-home piece of advice that you could share with us before you have to go?
I think the take-home piece of advice would be time. This is such a complicated issue. And in order to understand people properly, you really need to spend time with them, hear their story, learn about their journey, and develop a rapport with them. And I think if you've got that relationship of trust that just comes with time, then you have got more opportunity to help and support in the journey that lies ahead, wherever that may take them.
That's great. Thank you so much. Dr. Kate, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. I hope that you've enjoyed your time being here. And I hope for all of you listening that that's been really informative. Join us in 2 weeks' time when we'll be doing another episode of the First Incision, a CMF podcast. And until then, have a good 2 weeks and God bless.